is the operator. I'd like to inform parties this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thanks very much. Okay, the usual reminder, it's *6 to mute your phone if you have any noise in the background so it doesn't disturb the speaker. So today we have a bit of a change of pace. We usually have these science presentations, but today we're going to kind of focus on spacecraft engineering and operations. And the speaker is Julie Webster, and she's the spacecraft operations manager. She's been manager for, several years now, but has been at JPL for 15 years. And prior to Cassini, she worked on other missions, such as Magellan and Mars Observer. And she's going to talk about some recent activities on Cassini that sort of were necessary, critical engineering operations. She's going to tell us how they went, what they were, and how they went. And the title of her talk, which we struggled over a little bit, is That's Why We Carry Backup Hardware. So with that, I'll give it to Julie and go right ahead.
Okay. If you have any questions, go ahead and interrupt me whenever I go. But I'm on page 2 of the talk at this time. And I knew Marcia was desperate when she came down back to the engineering, because the last time I gave a charm talk was 3 years ago. Anyway, what we wanted to talk about is Cassini had kind of a major degradation, and we wound up swapping to redundant hardware this past March. And I wanted to give you a little bit of flavor of what we have to go through in order to do that. Most spacecraft carry redundant hardware in all engineering subsystems, except for the structure and the high gain. Of course, there's not two structures, two high gains. If you don't carry redundant hardware, sometimes you do like the rovers and carry a redundant mission. But in our case, we have redundant hardware in all the engineering subsystems. This is a very expensive proposition, partly because of hardware cost and also mass for the spacecraft. But if you can get past the hardware cost and mass, then you have to think about the fault protection logic, because there's no use in carrying redundant hardware if you can't swap over to it in the event of an anomaly. And Cassini has pretty extensive fault protection logic. And like I said, the alternative on a flagship mission is essentially unthinkable. So there's two ways to switch to redundant hardware. One is buy that fault protection system, which is, it does it for you if there's a fast failure that happens, you know, sooner than you can react on the ground, which is a minimum of, you know, between passes, we sometimes go 18, 19, 20, 24 hours, and also you have to be able to see the fault, get the command to the fault and react to the fault, and then have a 3-hour turnaround time. So fault protection is going to take care of you if you don't have time to do it from the ground. The other way, which is the way we always prefer, is if we see a degradation going on or an impending failure, we always try to switch on our time and our schedule and our money. And so we've had two times in the mission where we swapped redundant hardware. The first time was in 2003, before we even got into orbit. We actually had a reaction wheel that had already exhibited some anomalous behavior that we associated with impending failure. And so we replaced the third reaction wheel with the articulatable reaction wheel 4, which the articulatable, I don't know if that was a word, Spellcheck sure didn't like it. But it allows the reaction wheel 4 to literally articulate and be moved in the direction so that it can replace RWA-1, RWA-2, and RWA-3. But what I wanted to talk about today is the switching to the redundant set. And we have a saying, it's not my saying, I didn't invent this, but we say that down here on the engineering floor that scientists plan for the nominal, engineering plans for the off-nominal, and if they have the time and money, they plan for worst-case scenarios. And Cassini has been very lucky in that our fault protection and our redundant hardware is pretty extensively thought through before we do anything. But first I want to go back and describe to you what we're actually talking about with the thrusters. These are, and the propulsion world is one of the last bastions of still working in the English system instead of the metric system. So I'll switch between 1 newton and 2/10 pounders, which is, if you talk to a thruster guy, these still would be the 2/10 pounders. These are very small thrusters, but they account for our ability to make turns, to make fast turns, faster than the reaction wheels could go, or the ability to change and take out momentum out of the reaction wheels. And also we use it to control authority around Titan, close Titan flybys. These thrusters have a long heritage. They actually were called to the Voyager system, which launched in 1977. So clearly, you know, the people in the manufacturing, these aren't leftover Voyager thrusters, but they're very similar to the ones flown on Voyager, Magellan, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, Stardust, New Horizons. If you have the time and money and the mass, and Cassini did, and Voyager did too, Voyager and Cassini A-branch Z-facing thrusters, so 4 out of the 16 total, had chamber pressure transducers to measure the chamber pressure roughness during an actual thruster event. This is both a blessing and a curse. It helped us quickly identify the fault, but at the same time, if you don't have that, you may sometimes ignorance is bliss. And we do not have the pressure chamber transducers on the backup thrusters, on either the Z side or the Y facing thrusters. The next page is a page that I've done for you before, but to imagine these.
Which page?
I'm sorry. It is page. I was on page 3, and then I'm on page 4 with the picture.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
And this is the whole entire propulsion system. It is both the biprop, which is the majority of the picture here. The thrusters are the little tripod designs that stick out like legs from the system. And at the end of each one of those tripod clusters, there's two redundant thrusters facing down. If you can, you can kind of barely see them over to the right, lower right-hand corner. They're the kind of nozzle-shaped things down at the bottom of the little blue cluster at the end of that tripod. And
so there's something that looks kind of like a rectangular shape, and so it's pointing down from that?
Yes.
Okay.
If you can look down in the bottom, there's a little gold kind of nozzle-looking thing. Those are the Z-facing thrusters because they point in the Z direction, so they would propel the spacecraft up. And then there's a set of Y thrusters, and by using the combination of the Y and Z thrusters, we can maneuver in either X, Y, or a three-dimensional plane. So I really wanted a picture of one of these things, but I would have had to get all of you to sign a technical assistance agreement. So I have what is in the literature. I have kind of a picture on page 5 of what these thrusters look like. And you have to kind of see them and feel them to get a sense of the overall size of these things, but the entire picture on page 5, they're about 4 inches or 10 centimeters total. And the little De Laval nozzle, all of you that saw October Sky or read the book that October Sky was made from, remember the De Laval nozzle. That's the actual nozzle that directs the hydrazine out once it's gone through a cat bed and broken down into products that will be jetted out. That's about 2 centimeters, or it's actually less than an inch. It's about 3/4 of an inch long. So these are little tiny things. 2/10 pound is you could, if somebody pressed your hand with it, you'd have to be pretty sensitive to recognize 2/10 pound even on your hand. The let's see, this picture doesn't have the pressure transducer, so I won't talk about that. The hydrazine itself is run through, and if you can imagine this overall size is about 4 inches, then the capillary tube is literally a little 0.01-inch diameter capillary tube. That directs the hydrazine down through what is called the catalyst bed. And the catalyst bed is literally a bed of granules of alumina that have been coated with platinum iridium. To, you know, all of you that have some chemistry background, that is literally the catalyst that takes the hydrazine and breaks it down into the combustion products. So the cat bed is going to become very important in our discussion later on, the catalyst bed. So I'm on page 6. So why does it take so long for engineers to decide to do something? I'm absolutely fascinated by this. I've been working spacecraft for 25 years, and it's still a rule that I have to repeat to myself. You know, engineers make no decision before this time. So essentially what happened was on a little orbit trim maneuver, a very small maneuver back at the end of October, I'm on page 6, in October 29th on a orbit trim maneuver 169, the Z3A performance degraded. And this was a particularly bad maneuver to underperform because we had essentially like a 15 millimeter per second underperformance, and because of the moment arm and because of the way this particular maneuver was timed in the orbit, it cost us almost 5 meters a second on the main engine to correct for this bad maneuver. So at that point, we had everybody's attention, especially navigation, and we started looking into this, and we started looking into the fact that we were starting to see pressure chamber roughness on Z3A to the extreme, and then increasing pressure chamber roughness on Z4. Over the course of time, we had two more OTMs, and they didn't occur until late December and early January. We showed the continued degradation, and we didn't see Voyager experience these pressure chamber, and at first we kind of just wrote it off, but Voyager did not see the significantly lower thrust that we were getting. And so again, to describe this in picture form, page 7 shows this pressure chamber roughness as a matter of percent. And this is plus or minus the average pressure chamber. And you can see early in the mission, we started coming up, and we were really worried about this. TCM-07 was about year 2000, and we kind of kept an eye on it, and then it leveled out, and then we performed a recharge of the helium that pressurizes this hydrazine and gives it some pressure to get into the chamber. And that really leveled things out for a long time, as you can see from after that green line recharge all the way out until OTM-169, you can see where it starts to deviate dramatically, which was last October. And what I, to show the chamber pressure variations that we were getting, we went back and reconstructed several of these. And we had an OTM in August, page 8, and you can see where the average pressure was and the deviation that it was allowed, and you can see that it's almost exactly right on the average. And then you go to an OTM about 4 OTMs later, which was basically late September, and we started seeing some deviation in the pressure chamber, but nothing to cause great harm. We thought that this was still within spec. Those red lines are kind of a spec that Aerojet told us that they could perform within. And then you can look at page 10, and page 10 came in, and we had this OTM-169 where not only was the pressure chamber almost 100%, which means it was deviating down to almost zero, and then pegging way up above the instrumentation capability. So we were basically banging this thruster instead of doing a very smooth thrust, and that's what reduced the thrust and gave us such a bad performance on OTM-169. It still took a while. We still were surprised at all this, so we had to go back and regenerate a lot of our data. I'm on page 11 now. And the first thing you have to do, of course, is have a meeting, and you have to go through. So we had several meetings from November, December, as the propulsion people were talking with the thruster manufacturer and the propulsion teams. And then finally on January 22nd, they came to us and said, this is a bad thruster, and if this were in a test chamber, we would stop this thruster, and we wouldn't use it anymore because it had already exhibited end-of-life properties. And so they gave us the recommendation to swap. Now, that has to be sold to all levels of management, including top people at NASA. So we met with the chief engineer, and we met with the JPL management on the 26th and said, we're thinking about doing this. We're going to continue. And then in the meantime, my team started internal procedures to develop the plan and procedures. So what we did, and I'm on page 12 now, was we kind of identified a plan to set up a timely fashion, and we wanted to not fall off tour, missing any OTM. So at this point, we're having an OTM a week, which is a lot of OTMs, and we couldn't use that. So we had two times in mind. We had March and September. We kind of looked all through that, and on the next page I'll explain what happened. But as engineers who had the time and money to develop the worst case plan scenarios, of course we had a thruster B checkout plan developed in 2003. Pre-Saturn orbit insertion, and at the time, it was, you know, the first do no harm, so we didn't check out the B-branch thruster. We just thought, you know, we're going to need it when we come to it, and we checked that out. So now I'm on page 13. So why does it take so long from decision to thruster swap? To get to a thruster swap, it was actually only about 10 commands. It was very simple to do. We just opened the latch valve and then made prime the B-branch thrusters. But we have a rule that, you know, first do no harm. You have to take the time available to make it right. So you had to make sure that if you went over to these thrusters and they leaked, fault protection would catch you in a timely fashion, or that you could recover from it without putting the spacecraft into any kind of a spin. So as we looked all through the time and space, we found, you know, of course the testers wanted 6 months to go through all their fault protection actions and all their thing. Propulsion wanted this swap immediately, and science preferred a quiet time without priority science, and the spacecraft team and NAV wanted the maximum time between OTMs. So that worked out to be a time March 12th through the 18th. And so there were 6 weeks from decision to spacecraft, and based on what we saw in a continuation of the thruster A, we were very glad to get off. So even though we plan for all these worst-case scenarios, in reality, the entire swap was entirely nominal. Page 14. And that's pretty much the conclusion of my talk.
So you really whizzed through this material. Are there any questions for Julie? So how nerve-wracking was this? I mean, Cassini's been pretty flawless. I mean, I'm rack my brain and think of any other. There have been very few anomalies on the
screen. Only the reaction wheels.
Yeah.
Everything else has gone completely nominal. So we were kind of caught by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And we had planned for about 50% more lifetime out of these thrusters, so we were absolutely caught by surprise.
So now what about you don't have the, what do you call it, the pressure transducers, so you're not going to see any of the
right.
the roughness on this.
That's correct. So what we did is, navigation really tells us how good the thrusters are performing. They
yeah.
say they got this change in velocity, momentum, and we said, okay, we planned for this. We told the spacecraft to do this amount, and then navigation comes back and says, you did X amount where you wanted Y amount. And so navigation is really the telling factor. But we always, on the ACE side thrusters, had the chamber pressures to back us up. They're underperforming. Oh, why are they underperforming? We could get the chamber pressure data and said, oh, this is why they're underperforming. We don't have that luxury on the B side, and so some sharp people in attitude control and navigation have done extensive, they've taken the 6 weeks to develop almost immediate algorithms to be able to derive the thruster performance for every time we use these thrusters, whether it's a momentum bias, which we do about every 3 days, or an RCS OTM, which we do about once or twice every 16 days. And
so that would supplant the pressure transducer that you have
right,
in the
ABIS. Right. We
wow,
don't,
that's amazing.
We don't have the pressure transducers to corroborate the evidence, but you know, we were perfectly happy with the chamber pressure numbers until we had such a bad performance in October.
Yeah.
As a result of this, I think Stardust also took a look at their data and decided to swap over to their backup thrusters because they had lots of cycles on their thrusters.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of people all throughout industry that are tracking our performance numbers and what we think the ultimate cause is, which we have not really determined yet, although there are a lot of smart people, smart propulsion people working on it.
Mm-hmm. So you still have the option of going back if something went wrong with
yes,
the program,
that
right?
that was one of the most important things, and that was the only thing Charles Alagi asked us was, can you get back to thruster A's if something goes dramatically that you didn't you know, fire a pyro that you couldn't get back to the other side? And no, we can go back to the A's. The fault protection will take us back to the A's in the event that anything fast degrades on the thruster B side, or we can always track it and say which is the worst side. Or we're actually looking into a mode right now where we could choose the better of each thruster set from A or B. And go into mixed mode. The trick with the mixed mode is that you really don't have good fault protection for that, because fault protection just knows a thruster is leaking, close the main latch valve, which shuts off all 8 thrusters.
Hmm.
And so right now we're looking into how we can fly a mixed mode and still recover well in the event of another fault action.
Okay, interesting.
So, Julie, what other pieces of, what other items on the spacecraft have we gone to the redundant system on?
We check out, the sun sensors are carried, there's 2 sun sensors, and they're way up in the, on the high-gain antenna. And so when we go through these dust environments that are unsafe for the spacecraft surfaces and we turn the high-gain into the RAM direction, we always turn on the backup sun sensor and then get through the dust region and then check out both sun sensors and make sure they're always available to us, because the sun sensors are the last, they're kind of the last line of defense. If we can't find the sun with the spacecraft, we're really in a mess. So normally we figure out where the Earth is through the star tracker and through the inertial measurement unit, the gyros. But if we should lose or not trust the star tracker or the gyro measurements, the last line of defense is find the sun. And so we check out those sun sensors every time. Once a year, we swap out and check out the stellar reference unit, the star tracker. We swap over and we do a kind of an extensive camera check. Essentially, these are CCDs, not unlike the IFS camera, and so we check those out about once a year. The telecom we have not checked out, although we have swapped fault protection on the amplifiers on the X-band system, and that was due to a solid-state power switch trip, which we occasionally have. We eventually wrote fault protection to make that not happen, but we have checked out the backup amplifier. The backup computers for both the main computer that sends out the commands and gathers all the data, and for the attitude computer, we keep both of those on and in redundant mode all the time. Those are probably the major things. We check up the backup gyros about once a year. We'll swap over to the backup gyros and check them out. And let me think what else is in there. Oh, we actually carry a second main engine complete with all the plumbing from the bipropellant system, which we have never used and hopefully never will, because that involves a lot of actions, including firing pyro valves that we would like to stay away from.
Does anybody else have any questions for Julie? Maybe even if you just want to, change the topic and ask her anything about what it's like to run a big spacecraft like Cassini. Maybe that might be interesting to some of the people online. Anything else for Julie?
So, Julie, Voyager has had quite a few cycles on their thrust after 31 years in flight. Do you know how they're doing? Do they have pressure?
They have two different sets of thrusters, which they use one set of thrusters all in what I call the Z direction for these little trim maneuvers or correction maneuvers, these little RCS maneuvers that go up to about a half a meter per second. They have a separate set of thrusters for that, and then they have the control thrusters. Since Voyager is a spinner, and their spin, they only have to have one other set of thrusters.
No, it's three-axis stabilized.
Well, it can be, but it also spins, doesn't it?
Just for mag rolls once a month.
Oh, okay. Well, they have different thrusters that keep the three-axis stabilized, and so one of the things that we're investigating is. Maybe, by the way, they did swap their thruster cluster. They swapped that over about 20 years into the mission. They had swapped their set of thrusters, but that was because of throughput that they had long ago lasted longer than they expected to go. And one of the failure mechanisms that we're investigating is the fact that we use them for both orbit trim maneuvers and for control. And the reason that's significant is it's the amount of time you fire. When you fire for an RCS maneuver or an OTM, you fire for several seconds. And so there's a lot of hydrazine, but there's only really one come up to temperature and then cycle down. When we do the trims or the turns or the momentum bias, we deadband because we're holding attitude with the thrusters, we fire for little tiny pulses down to 7 milliseconds, and that involves its own temperature cycle, which could be multiple temperature cycles per event. So that's one of the things that we're looking into, in that using them both ways may have prematurely worn them out. One of the things that I have to laugh, it was about, what, Marcia, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that we proposed this mission to 2017.
Oh, right.
And at first, my very first thought was, oh, that's so wonderful, this will get me to retirement. And then as soon as I went through that thought, I stopped and said, oh my God, how am I going to get this spacecraft to last for 10 years longer than it was really intended to last?
That's amazing.
So, so one of the things, having this, you know, we're just now exploring the get to 2017 and what does that mean and what spacecraft resources do we have to have, and we were just kind of hashing through that whole process of what do we need to do to get the spacecraft to 2017 when the A-branch thrusters started exhibiting this degradation. And I did lose a lot of sleep over this, mostly because now we've got eight more years to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a while to last on, we initially thought just the gas, you know, the hydrazine itself was going to be the limiting factor, but it may turn out to be the use of the thrusters that may be a limiting factor, and we'll have to figure all that into what kind of mission we fly in the extended mission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The rest of the spacecraft, I think, in terms of the computers and the actual other hardware, I truly believe that we could be a Voyager class mission and last a really long time if we didn't want to do a lot of science.
Are there any other questions for Julie? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Julie. This has been very interesting. And again, you know, different than our normal science talk.
I do have a question.
Okay.
I'm a question about the reaction wheels.
Uh-huh.
You know, I almost never see them in any photographs of spacecraft when they're partially dismantled. I just always wondered, how large are they? Where are they located? Where are they oriented?
Gosh. They're down near the bottom of the spacecraft. If you go back on the propulsion system, which I, of course, don't have the reaction wheels on there, but if you go back to page, is it five?
I'm looking at that.
Four. Page four. If you looked down at the bottom of that, the reaction wheels actually fit. I'm gonna look at my model here. They're at the lower level, and they're just about the level of the thruster clusters attached to the main portion of the spacecraft. There's a lower assembly that goes in under here, and they're placed not exactly 120 degrees apart. They're a little bit different in orientation, so they don't exactly align. So one reaction wheel doesn't carry the whole force of changing in the X direction or the Y direction. They each kind of share the load. And so there's two that are about, they're about 60 degrees apart, and then the third one is about, I'm turning my model as we speak. The third one is about 90 degrees off from the other two. They're, you know, I would know this number if you hadn't asked me, but they're actually about 20 kilograms. They're fairly heavy. They're just a very large spinning magnet, and they make a fair amount of noise. In fact, we cover them. The reason you almost never see them in pictures is because they have a huge cover on them to reduce the actual noise that you could hear it if you were around on the spacecraft. You could actually hear it in the human frequency range. They actually kind of rumble. And let's see. So they're covered up. And then the fourth reaction wheel, which was the articulatable one that can be driven to match the direction of any one of the other three, it's up above where the, if you still look on page five, there's a description above the dome that's a support cage that's removed. It's about at dome level in between the RPWS antennas and the ORS pallet is actually where it is. It's kind of located just between those two, and so it's completely covered up with the thermal blanket, so you'd never see it.
And do these are they spinning all the time?
Yes. Well, we turn them off, not all the time, because we turn them off for these for any reaction control events. So we turn them off for an RCS maneuver, for example, or we turn them off like when we do a Titan flyby and we need the control authority of the thrusters. We turn them off then. We also have to turn them off for power reasons. They take about 90 watts of power, and when you're down around, what are we today, 600 and some odd watts, and the basic spacecraft itself takes about 350 just to keep the spacecraft on. So they're a big power hit, and so we frequently have to turn them off for radio science or reduce their power load. Say you can't make any fast turns on the reaction wheels.
And when they're turned off, do they maintain some spinning, or do you actually?
No, we actually spin them down to zero and actually turn them off. During the momentum bias, is most spacecraft talk about unloads where they spin up to the top and then they unload automatically. We don't do that. Because of the reaction wheel problem in 2003, in 2000, and then we're swapping in 2003, we maintain these reactions. We baby them. We drive the scientists crazy because we're always saying, oh, the reaction wheels can only go between these limits, and if you sit too much time in the low RPM time, that causes the lubricant to not be spinning all the way correctly. So we do what we call biases. So except when they're turned off for a Titan event or for power reasons or for an RCS maneuver, they're pretty much on and spinning at some controlled level all the time.
And for other spacecraft, are they generally about the same size, or do they adjust the mass according to the spacecraft mass?
They do adjust the mass according to the spacecraft mass and size. I've seen some. There's not a whole lot of smaller ones. There are some much larger ones on other spacecraft, but essentially they're about. I'm looking at my hands because they're about 18 inches across. I should look up those numbers and add a information for your charm people, Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh, I will.
Yeah, well, we know they do an awful lot with managing spacecraft, but it was unseen.
It's really interesting because the two things that you have to have, you know, to make any turn at all, it's either the reaction wheels or the thrusters, and of course those are the two things that have given us problems, and so we'll probably be babying and trading off, you know, do we use the momentum wheels more here or do we use the thrusters more here? We'll probably be making that trade-off every year throughout the rest of the mission.
Oh, thank you.
That's cool.
Any other questions for Julie? Sounds like a no. So, well, thank you very much, Julie. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's fairly short, but mostly.
Yeah, that's okay.
What I wanted to mostly make is I continue to be fascinated with from the time when you know something to when we actually
act on it on
the spacecraft. And again, you know, we will make no decision before it's time.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to hear about that process. So thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, so next month we've got, again, a change of pace. We've got a young graduate student from Imperial College in London. His name's Adam Masters, and he's finishing up a PhD with Michelle Dougherty. And he's going to tell us about the magnetosphere. So that'll be next month. And then after that, we have the fifth anniversary. Fifth already? Wow. So that's a two-month presentation. I'm still trying to line up speakers for that, but it'll the speakers will talk about the highlights, science highlights for all the different disciplines on Cassini for the whole year. So that'll be hopefully June and July. So with that, I think we're done, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.